You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 83 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with the show on Twitter by following us at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today, we're going to be looking at the online discussions around migration across the EU and what type of narratives are arising organically out of platforms like Twitter and Instagram and online news comments. And I'm going to be speaking with Katta Füge. She is a researcher and social media analyst at Bakamo Social, the company who produced that report. And you may remember way back in episode 20, we interviewed Daniel Fajikas, the CEO of Bakamo Social, about a study they did mapping the online narratives around the 2017 French presidential elections. So they have a new study out focusing on migration narratives across the EU. And we're going to dive into the findings and the methodology of that study, which I think are quite interesting, not just for people interested in what are the online discussions around Europe or migration, but also some data scientists who might be curious to see how this study was conducted, which was basically by mapping the online conversations in six countries, doing a close reading of those texts and categorizing them into five narratives. And those are security, identity, humanitarianism, economy, and demographics. And then basically using this training set of six countries, they were able to broaden out those categories across the EU and see to what extent migration was discussed in relation to these categories. And there's a cool interactive dashboard that you can go check out. I'll link to it in the show notes, but you can kind of click on the different narratives and see the prevalence of each narrative ranked by country, or click on the country and see how the narratives seem to be playing out there. So we're going to get into the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts of the data science towards the end of the interview and talk about the main findings in the front. But I think this type of research is really important to just get a descriptive look at what are everyday conversations online discussing in the context of migration, and then comparing that across Europe to look at similarities and differences. And I think one of the most interesting findings that comes out of this study is that people tend to use the same narratives around migration. So they might be talking about the security implications or the economic implications. But the way they do it is often very rooted in local issues. So it's a pan-European narrative, but at the micro level, discussed in terms of what's going on in people's communities and their regions. So I think it's an interesting dynamic between the local and the supranational. And we're going to pick apart exactly how Katta thinks of that, having looked at all this data and spent so much time on the study. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Katta Füge. She is a social media analyst at Bakamo Social. Katta, thanks so much for taking the time out. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thank you so much, Michael, for inviting me.
So to start off, why don't we discuss the overall aims of your project? What were you seeking to understand about migration, and why did you turn to online discussions as a data source?
Yeah, so the overall goal for our research was to map out the discussions around migration in all EU member states, and we wanted to identify the key narratives around the discourse. We were very much interested in two things. First, we wanted to see if there is a unified European discourse, so if there are any kind of similarities between how people address the migration issue in different EU member states. And the other key question that we really wanted to figure out is whether there are any kind of positive or progressive narratives that might emerge around migration in everyday people's conversations.
Yeah, it's interesting. And we're going to dig into that report as we go along. But when I first read it, I was thinking, you know, migration encompasses such a wide range of meanings, right? You have migration, immigration, people migrate for different reasons, and people also feel about migration very differently. So can you clarify how you defined migration in the study?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is true that they might feel in so many different ways, or there might be so many different attitudes. Our goal was to encompass all of that. But there is one more challenge about the word migration, because obviously, if you think about policy or academia, this is a very, very specific term. And you might be thinking, okay, have we included refugees or asylum seekers or immigrants, or did we look at these terms differently? But since this is a social media listening project, and we were at the end of the day looking at everyday people's conversations, we sort of use these terms quite interchangeably. So we were trying to understand how people, of course, talk about the migration crisis and the influx of people from outside of the EU to the EU member states. And for that reason, in the report and also in our research, we use these terms as a mix, relatively.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of our previous episodes, we're talking about how diplomats and heads of state craft strategic narratives, and migration could be one of those. I think when state actors use the term, they're really using it in a calculated way, whereas citizens, I guess you want to capture all the different words that associate with migration in order to get an idea of what the everyday person is saying.
Yeah, that's completely true. And as we were presenting our report and during the reception of the report, a lot of people were asking these questions and saying, okay, but these are not clarified terms. And this is all true. And I think the reason why social listening was a great method to look at this very complex problem is because we were not really measuring how well the public understands these terms. We wanted to understand the attitudes around this whole issue.
Right, right. I think that's a good justification for kind of everyday political talk. Mm. But I want to dig into the specific aspects of the methodology a bit later on. But as we're talking about everyday conversations on social media and online, what platforms were you looking at? And then how did you actually identify these discussions?
Yeah, so we scraped public social media platforms in a one-year time frame. So we were looking at conversations between the end of July 2017 until the beginning of August 2018. And these platforms included forums, blogs, Twitter, Instagram, and also content posted on online news sites. These included both the articles and comment sections. And we identified relevant comments through keywords. So basically, we had this semantic keyword grid, which we first prepared in English, and then these were translated into all the official languages of the target countries. And during the analysis, we first captured the comments by these keywords, and then we were sifting for relevancy in a way. So we used human readers to recognize when migration is being used in a relevant context. So obviously, our goal was to exclude all comments which are talking about cloud migration or the migration of birds, but just to focus on the key issue. And so at the end, then we ended up with a large amount of relative comments.
Yeah, and I want to kind of, I mean, there's a lot to dive in on the study. And as I talked about in the intro, and as is in the episode description, you can go on to the website and basically play around with an interactive tool that kind of shows the different narratives. But maybe we should start with the five big narratives that you found, which were security, identity and customs, humanitarianism, the economy and demographics. So can you kind of go into those narratives and kind of what the report found out about them?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to give a brief description for all of these five things, first, it's very important to emphasize that we were aiming to recognize topic-based narratives. So first, security, as you mentioned, is pretty much about the threat that migration might pose on a given country. And in this group, we had, for example, attacks that were committed by migrants or different terror events. So basically anything or any ways how the refugee crisis might have influenced the security of the given member state. Then identity was about the cultural influence of refugees and migrants, and also how the arrival of refugees influenced the social cohesion of the given country. Then the third narrative was humanitarianism, and this is kind of the classic narrative that we have already had in Europe. And that talks about the difficult circumstances that refugees have to endure and what kind of support mechanisms there might be in the different member states. The fourth category was economy. that talks about the economic burden refugees or migrants pose on member states and, of course, on the EU at large as well. And there is a very interesting thing, which is about the zero-sum game between locals and migrants for the social benefits. And then the last one is demographics, and that is a bit more specific than the economy narrative because it talks pretty much about the labor market integration of migrants in the context of the emerging demographic crisis and how potentially refugees or migrants can be an answer for this problem.
Right. So these are five kind of overarching narratives that you found around these various keywords around migration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it kind of resonates with what you'd think people would be discussing about. But there were two that were particularly pronounced, right? I think the security and identity were the ones that were the most dominant. Is that right? And maybe why do you think that is?
Yeah, this is correct. And they also had a very interesting interplay. So basically, as I mentioned already, humanitarian approach or the humanitarian support would be the classic argument that you would think would come up in the migration discussion. But in the past couple of years, and as the migration crisis has been emerging, basically the influence on local security and the influence on local identity became very strong and very pronounced. And for example, our data showed that the security narrative was huge in countries like Poland and Hungary. And for quite a lot of analysts, this comes as no surprise because this is in the news. This is sort of a well-known fact. What was maybe more interesting for us is to see the emerging narrative of identity in countries, for example, as Germany, the Netherlands, or Belgium. So in countries which had like a longer history of migration and people with migrant background in the country, somehow in the past couple of years, this identity narrative really strengthened up. One very interesting example was for us Belgium, where the two parts of the country really separated in this topic as well.
Right, the Flemish-speaking part and the French-speaking part?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, while the French-speaking part, Wallonia, they were like very proud about their heritage of immigration and they were emphasizing the humanitarian aspect so much more and the support that they need to give to refugees. In the northern part in Flanders, the nationalist agenda was much stronger and that somehow kind of tugged into the separation discourse. So how people were emphasizing that, oh yeah, our identity is more important than that of refugees and we should somehow stop this influx.
Yeah, and I want to kind of keep picking apart these frames because it's, you know, these are very, as you said, they're sort of topical clusters mm-hmm. of a narrative. But within those, you can be either kind of pro or against a certain narrative. And I think that's a tricky thing to kind of unpack, but something that you discuss nicely in the report, especially around humanitarianism, where you can actually say, you know, we shouldn't be humanitarian towards migrants. That'd be kind of an anti-migrant position. But then you can also be sort of pro-humanitarianism by criticizing that the government isn't doing enough about humanitarianism. So can you discuss those kind of positive and negative evaluations within the individual narratives?
Yeah, exactly. So our goal was pretty much to focus on topics. This is also a little bit in connection with how we used the AI tool to categorize the comments. But also we really try to focus on keeping the sentiments, I mean, differing sentiments within one narrative. So this is actually quite straightforward in cases such as identity, because in that case, a pro-migration voice would be like multiculturalism is really good, whereas anti-migration voice would say Muslims threaten the European identity and they shouldn't be allowed in Europe. Also, this is more straightforward in questions as economy, where the anti-migration voice would say that we have no money to support refugees and the pro-migrant person would say or would suggest that our country might receive more EU funding if we allow more migrants in the country. But in case of humanitarianism, this is a perfect example that you were saying, because even though it sounds like the classical supportive argument, In some cases, especially, we've seen a lot of examples for this in Italy and Hungary. For example, when Italy was closing the ports in front of refugees, some people were saying this is a great step for Italy because it protects the country, whereas other people were coming from the humanitarian perspective saying that this is a terrible act against migrants.
Mm-hmm. And just thinking about these different, you know, when you mention Italy, I think because, you know, they're right there on the border, or Hungary is, you know, it's in the middle of Europe, but it was at that kind of border, or it made itself a border, basically.
Absolutely.
During the migration crisis. So do you notice differences in attitude towards migration or these narratives around where the countries sort of physically are in Europe, that border countries might be discussing migration more in a different way?
Yeah, there is definitely a geographic part or a geographic reason for these attitudes, but also it's quite interesting that the geographic location does not really define the overall approach.
Yeah, I see Poland on here, which is right in the middle, is
exactly.
One of the top countries.
Yeah. And I would say that this is pretty much, depending on which narratives are the biggest in the country, has a lot of reasons. So in some cases, it is very much connected to how the government communicates. For example, Hungary is an excellent example for that. The actual crisis or the actual influx of refugees was large only in a particular, relatively small time frame of 2015. Mm-hmm. But the Hungarian government did keep up this whole agenda for quite a long time. And that really influenced the discourse and the topics within the discourse.
Yeah. So basically the fact that the political class or the media is continuing to bring this into the public debate, it might resonate with the online conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the local issues have very strong connection here as well. So depending on what is the particular local anxiety in the given country also influences the given narrative that is the strongest in the country.
Yeah, I definitely want to dive into that local aspect in a second, but I want to stick on this pro and anti-migrant narrative, because one of the findings of the study is you write that no resonating progressive or migration-supporting narratives have been found. So was it the case that the anti-migration narratives were far outweighing the pro-migration?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people would assume that this is because of social media, so that obviously the negative content triggers a lot more buzz, and that is why in researches like this, we can hear a lot more from that area. Mm-hmm. But I would also say that recognizing all of the anxieties and recognizing how basically the migration topic is pretty much just a vessel to discuss or address frustrations that are alive and present in the given country. I would say this is why it's very difficult to identify or pinpoint positive narratives or progressive narratives, or even just a couple of issues that you would think, oh, okay, I can talk about this particular issue when it comes to migration, and then it will resonate more positively within public. We didn't really identify issues like that.
Right. So it's kind of this this idea of othering or scapegoating, where there's real problems in the country or the local context, but it gets discussed about in the context of migration when that may or may not be the actual cause of these problems.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So another question I had looking at these different narratives is, you know, we have, let's say, security, economy, demographics, these different ones, but these are not particularly all the time things that can be broken down into distinct narratives, right? They kind of reinforce or undermine one another. You can think of, you know, the economy also falling into the securitization category, for example. So I'm wondering how you see these different narratives and how they, you know, you break them down into distinct entities, but they are actually kind of working together somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a very strong interplay between the different categories. And actually, again, channeling a little bit back to humanitarianism, this has been, especially as the migration crisis broke out, a lot of countries thought that, okay, this is the attitude towards the migration crisis within the majority of the public. But actually, as we have been conducting this research towards the end of 2018, we have recognized that the humanitarian message resonates less and less with people. Mm. And actually, there are other issues and other narratives that are much stronger. And these other aspects really reshape the whole conversation. And we can see a very strong sort of an anti-elitist narrative that are, you know, the motivating factor or the back of all of these narratives. So basically, instead of humanitarianism being strong, we could see that the security and the identity narratives were becoming much stronger. And most of the cases, they were supporting the anti-migration approach.
Right, right. And I think what's interesting about it, getting back to this idea of local issues, is that, you know, these narratives, they get stronger or they get weaker depending on, I guess, different contextual factors. But I think what's interesting is you identify these narratives that are pan-European, but they're rooted in very local concerns and very local issues. So can you discuss that kind of dynamic between the pan-European and the local? I think that's an interesting kind of meta level to your study.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And I also think that this is pretty much the most interesting part of what we found and a very surprising one for us. Because at first, as I mentioned, we were looking for pan-European narratives. But through the analysis, we really had to recognize that there were a lot of local issues and basically local tensions that really drove the conversation around migration. And yeah, as I mentioned, at the end, we recognized that migration is pretty much just a vessel for local tensions and local problems. For example, the case of Romania is super interesting because in the past couple of years, the emigration of Romanian workers to other EU member states have been really strong. And this means quite a large number, I mean, in the millions of Romanian citizens who left the country. And that created a context in which, when the migration crisis was coming, people's attitudes were very different because there were a couple of voices, which we have also seen on social media, when people were saying that, oh, not even the migrants would want to stay in a country like this. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we can say that the Romanian exodus sort of is a huge local problem that really influences the migration discourse as well. Another one is the Flemish independence that we've talked about already. Or, for example, the Finnish welfare state is a very interesting example too, channeling to the narrative of the economy. So that a lot of Finnish people say that we have a very strong welfare state, and if we allow migrants to come in, then we really need to measure the cost of this and the impact on our stability or on our economic stability.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, it reaffirms this truism that all politics is local, but then also seeing it kind of manifest across Europe, I think is super interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. The only point is that it's interesting how obviously the migration problem is an EU level problem. So there were a lot of conversations about, you know, how can we deal with this in you know, a cross national level. But at the end of the day, the national context, the national problems really influence the whole conversation.
Right, which gets to this idea. I know we're recording before the European Parliament elections, but you know, there you have the same dynamic where, you know, it's a pan-European campaign, but it's pretty much done at the national level, and a lot of national and local issues end up guiding who goes to Brussels to represent that country. So, did you find anything relating to the European Parliament elections, or some dynamic that you think might play into them as we head into them soon?
Yeah, well, this is a very, very tricky question, I would say. But indeed, it's super interesting how this issue, I mean, the whole migration problem, is being used as a tool during the campaign. So, for example, in Hungary, this is one of the biggest topics that the leading political party Fidesz is using in the European parliamentary election campaign. So it's quite interesting how that channels into a tool, basically, through which political campaigns can be built.
Yeah, and of course, we can't say, you know, to what extent these narratives influence the vote. But I think it connects to what you said earlier about the fact that countries like Poland and Hungary were keeping this in the public debate. That serves as a kind of primer, I guess, when the parties are trying to mobilize people. They draw on the past narratives in order to get them to go vote.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that talks about the fear, the very much underlying fear that is present in a lot of the voters. So this narrative works.
Right, right. So I want to dive into a bit to some of the nuts and bolts of the study and, you know, put you under the in the hot seat for a bit and look at the actual analysis of the data and the processes and steps that you took. Because I think it's interesting how you look at the data qualitatively and then use some tools to broaden it out. But as I understand it, you originally started by looking at six countries: Germany, Poland, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Hungary, and then used that as the core of the analysis before moving it to the rest of Europe. So I was curious why you chose those six countries.
Yeah, so exactly as we mentioned this earlier, it's about the different geographic locations on one hand. So we wanted to pick countries from various points of Europe to really see the influence on that level. Then we also were keeping in mind to have countries in the original pool which had a different economic context. And also, we really wanted to first read countries which assumedly have some sort of different general approach to migration. So I would think that, Ireland and Spain, there will be more pro-migrant, and Poland and Hungary will be more in the anti-migrant spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have these differences. I think it's a good kind of cross-section of Europe. But I wanted to ask how, because the way that you did it was you analyzed these conversations to identify the narratives and then broaden them out. So I'm wondering if there's anything you might have missed by looking at these six countries, that in terms of pan-European narratives by looking at six countries. Do you see that how that might cause some implications for the findings, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was definitely a thread that we tried to keep in mind during the analysis. And it was very important for us as we proceeded with the rest of the countries after six focus ones to recognize and to really identify if there were like anything left out. Mm-hmm. But basically, the whole analysis really validated our framework. And what we have recognized is that the conversation in every country, we were able to categorize the conversations in each country into these five narratives, but the local issues which appeared in every country were very, very unique. And eventually we recognized that, okay, the way we are going to expand the framework is that we have the five narratives, but we have these local issues which are basically different and not really, comparable among the countries.
Mm-hmm. But those local issues could still be grouped into one of these five.
Yeah, most of the time, yes.
Most of the time, okay. Because I'm really curious to hear about that process of jumping from the six country data set to the broader one, and you used some artificial intelligence or machine learning tools to do that. So, can you describe kind of what that tool is and how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, during the whole process, we used the Talkwalker platform, which is a social media scraping platform. And it also has a lot of analytical tools and the machine learning component. So Talkwalker did not only allow us to access these public social media platforms, but also it supported us with the categorization. And after we identified the narrative frameworks through the six focus countries, we proceeded through every country with the local analysts. So first, what happened was that the local analysts were reading the comments, and they were simultaneously training the Talkwalker's machine learning algorithm. Mm-hmm. So that meant that until a certain extent, until the AI really picked up on the structure, they were categorizing the comments. And then when the AI was ready to continue, then it was basically the machine that was categorizing. And at the end of that process, we have checked the random sample with the analysts to really validate the AI's performance. It was actually pretty good. And the biggest advantage in this for us was that it was really fast and really enabled us to read a lot more comments and categorize a lot more comments than we could have done with working human analysts only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like hearing about the various validation measures, because sometimes, people might take some tools and just let them loose without checking the output.
Yeah, maybe we need a couple more years for that. But at this point, it was really important for us to experiment with this. And also the fact that we have used these topic-based categories, we figured that it might be working actually very well if we use the AI. And luckily, that was the result.
Nice. I'm curious about the Talkwalker platform and the type of data that it gives. So it scrapes social media, Twitter, Instagram, you get the online news articles and some forums. But where did the majority of the data actually come from? I can imagine that maybe the online news outweighed some of the Twitter data in countries that don't really use Twitter, for example. So do you have an idea about, you know, the distribution of the data across different countries and maybe if one source might explain a lot of the findings?
Yeah, this is completely correct, your assumption about the different tools in the different countries and their importance. But the thing is that we have the data from forums, blogs, Twitter, Instagram also, and online news content. We have a quite detailed breakdown for each country in all the country reports that are accessible through our website. So all of this data can be seen. And of course, that can be added to the analysis. And you can read the comments through that lens, really. It is true that the strongest platform always differed according to the country specifics. So, for example, while obviously in Western European countries, Twitter is much stronger and a lot more like everyday people would use it and not only journalists, let's say, whereas in Eastern Europe, it's more of a trend that Twitter is a platform of journalists or politicians in that sense. But our goal really was to look for authentic comments and to find everyday people's voices. So basically, I really see no problem with that. And I am pretty sure that we could kind of keep all of the local context and the local cultural, influences that way, whichever platform was the strongest, we were looking at that.
Mm-hmm. Because my guess, having done a bit of this analysis, would be that the online news articles would be the most consistent and robust data source across the countries, which therefore, assuming that these are written by journalists, I'm wondering how, you know, to what extent the everyday conversations are captured when the articles would be written by journalists. So are you actually isolating the everyday conversations, or are you also capturing some elite discourse in the conversation, which makes sense because that's going to influence the public opinion to some extent. But I'm just wondering if, you know, if that kind of interferes with the everyday conversations online with the journalist input included.
Absolutely. And exactly. So this is what we were looking for, how everyday people's perceptions are influenced. And if they go on online social media platforms, their opinion will be influenced by other people's, content, but also by social media. Now, in countries where, let's say, this is not that balanced, and where within the online sphere, the professional content is a lot stronger, we have seen this in Bulgaria or in Hungary, then obviously those contents have a relatively larger role.
Right. Yeah, we have some data scientists listening, so I definitely want to pick those, pick that apart. My last question is, do you think the findings would have been different if Facebook was included? Because we know it's difficult to get the Facebook data. It's more or less impossible at the moment. But that's kind of where I think a lot of these discussions would be happening, you know, in private networks that we couldn't get to anyways. But do you think that might have changed or altered your findings in any way?
Yeah, that's very interesting because the Facebook's API access to public pages have been kind of on and off in the past couple of years. And during the analysis, we did not have any access to Facebook data. But it's exactly what you're mentioning too. So Talkwalker has only access to the public content that would be posted on Facebook and not, you know, private pages or conversations or private profiles. So I do not think that if we had access to Facebook content, we had different results because we were looking at public social media platforms anyway. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that whatever people would feel comfortable sharing on public platforms, they did outside of Facebook too. And so in that sense, it's pretty important that, of course, this research is also GDPR compliant. So basically, even though we are not asking questions to our, you know, quote unquote respondents, we do only analyze their content that they post online voluntarily, knowing that that content that they have posted can be accessed by anyone.
Right. I think it's a, there's limitations with any study and also particularly with this type of data. But I love how you're able to map it across all the different countries and use some interesting tools to do it. So Kata, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing the study with us.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was a pleasure.
I've just been speaking with Kata Fuga. She is a social media analyst at Bakamo Social. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. Got some great episodes lined up for you coming out, focusing on the concept of authenticity. So stay tuned for that. Until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.